Thank you for coming. I'm usually not very good at introductions, but this time I don't have to do much of an introduction to introduce Bernard Casey to you. He's been linked to the, he's been visiting the Hellenic Observatory for a number of years, and he's been participating in the LISI and the HO seminars for long. He comes actually from LSE. I first met him in the literature when he was writing things about part-time employment and labor market reforms at the Thatcher era in Britain, I think. But his research obviously relates more to social policy, social security, long-term care, and issues like that, and he's going to talk about pension reforms. He's been working as senior economist in the OECD and worked in projects related to the European Commission. He currently holds a Horizon 2020 project on looking at, I didn't know that, the super mandatory supplementary pension system in Australia.
No. That's nothing to do with the Horizon 2020.
Okay. I thought, where's the Horizon 2020 connection there?
This is why it's Horizon, it's way.
Yes, yeah. But he has looked at Australia as well as other countries. So today he's going to talk to us about pension reforms in the West Balkans and their neighbours. Bernard, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Okay, it is a pleasure being here in a small and intimate group of people, most of whom I've known for a very long time and most of whom are fairly dear to me. So it's actually nice to be amongst you lot. And, those of you who read the website announcement of this might have thought that I was going to present this in my fluent Serbian, which you would have seen. But unfortunately, my interpreter Tainer is away skiing at the moment, so I'm going to have to do it not in Serbian for you, because I don't know how many other people speak Serbian here, but that's pretty good. But anyway, I am returning to one of my sort of earlier interests, or actually still long-term interest, which is in the issue of pensions, because in fact I work on the economic implications of societal ageing, and the fact that I am now working rather more on the frail elderly and less on pensions, which means I moved up a bit in age, doesn't mean that I have lost an interest in this. I hope, and possibly because Tainer is not here, that we won't have to have an argument about what constitutes the Balkans stroke West Balkans. I know that this is a slightly sore point amongst people at not only LISI, but also in the Hellenic Observatory, and then also for people like me who have a long-term interest in places like Cyprus, and nobody knows where to put it in any case. Maybe because Dimitris, who I think it is now common knowledge, is moving off to the EBRD, he might have a view about where it gets located and where some of these places are, but we'll leave this for another occasion. So, talking about pensions, I had been interested in pension reform right back from the time, certainly when I was working at the OECD quite a long time ago, and I had mainly been interested in OECD countries. Then I got interested in New Europe, partly as a result of the work I was doing at OECD, which at one stage was looking at what were called non-member countries, but countries which were lining up to join. But those were the Central and Eastern European countries. And as a result of participating in LISI events, I got interested in sort of moving a bit further south and a bit further east. Or possibly, if I was talking about Cyprus, I was moving back a little bit further north and a little bit further west. So the current presentation comes out of this, and it comes also partly out of having been hauled in on occasions. I was hauled in as a consultant to the World Bank 2 or 3 years ago on some project which they had on pensions in what they kind of termed Eurasia. I'm not quite exactly sure what area of the world that they really were looking at, but it kind of included this area of the world and some of the bits of the world which are slightly closer to people here's interests. So I'm going to talk about approximately four subject areas, and I know that a lot of people here are not pensions specialists. If you're a pension specialist like I am, I mean, you can talk about kind of arcane issues until the cows come home, and there are some things which, you know, I can't assume an awful lot of knowledge from all of this audience, though I can assume a bit more knowledge from some people than others. So I hope that I will give you a bit of an introduction to how some kinds of pension systems work as we're going along, and I will be talking quite a lot about the difference between kind of tax and social security contributed pension schemes, where money is collected up by effectively a government or a social security agency and transferred straight out again to people who have claims that they've built up. So people have pensions, so money just comes straight in and goes straight out. And what are called funded pension schemes, where effectively individuals are participating in savings projects, effectively to some extent on their own account, and then at some stage later they are getting back that which they have saved up. And those are sort of two big differences in pension schemes, which are important when we are talking about this part of the world, and actually create quite a lot of what's been going on and quite a lot of the challenges which not only this part of the world, but you also see other parts face. What I wanted to start off with was just saying a little tiny bit about what does this part of the world look like in terms of the context. And I think that the interesting point about it is that it's actually not vastly different from other places which we know in terms of its population structure. And there is only one exception to that. Those of you who were at the Kosovo foreign minister the other day will remember him saying that Kosovo is the youngest of these countries in this part of the world. And that was one of his sort of specialities or distinguishing features. But the rest of this part of the world actually looks demographically much like the rest of Europe. And therefore, I mean, the population ageing challenges that are faced are not very different from anywhere else. Years ago, I worked in what was West Germany, and in those days there was a kind of anticipation that only, you know, kind of if only Germany got reunited, half the demographic problems of West Germany would get solved, because there was some kind of anticipation that there was a different demographic structure over there. And then on the interesting night of November in 1989, when when it engaged in a major pension reform, which had just gone through Parliament, the biggest pension reform in 10 years worth of pension reform, went through Parliament that day, and the same evening the Berlin Wall fell down, and all the presumptions on which that pension reform they sort of had collapsed. But the thing that they discovered was actually the pension, that the demographics over there were no different, and if anything, were possibly worse. So we've got all those, all the demographic problems, plus the kind of issues that are associated with emerging markets, countries in transition, and this has its own implications for labour market structures, and therefore people who are paying taxes, people who are working at all, whether they're working in a registered fashion. One's also got the standard problems, which are the problems of most of Western Europe or Central Europe as well, but also this or the same fiscal pressures, and to some extent worse fiscal pressures, because not only are the things which are creating the problems rather the same, but that pressure from outside to comply and to behave fiscally responsibly is greater on small emerging economies who are dependent upon outside assistance in one way or another. And you know, kind of it's the same kind of things but more so. And then another perhaps difference to at least Western Europe is the nature of capital markets and financial institutions there, which are also correspondingly deeply underdeveloped, and that has a lot to say about particular forms of pension financing. So you've not only got the problems of tax collection and distribution, which are the problems, but also if you are trying to operate savings type systems and financial market based systems in countries where financial markets are highly underdeveloped, you can sort of see that where some of the problems are likely to come. I tried to put together some sort of pictures of what these systems look like in the various countries, and collected this up from a variety of things, including the World Bank study, which I was sort of acting as a consultant to, but also later developments. I think one of the things which is worth noting here, if the middle column of this called public pay gap. I mean, for those of you who are who know less about these things, these are sort of fairly standard, insofar as these are standard, tax, social security contribution, financed pension systems which collect money in and give money out. The first column of tax, finance, universal, these are kind of pension systems which usually pay some kind of often minimum, often kind of anti-poverty type pension, which kind of everybody more or less gets, almost by virtue of possibly by age and or residence, but possibly not much more than that. And the mandatory savings accounts, this is the kind of more recent innovation, which is actually where somehow money is being collected together into individual savings accounts, and somehow there is something which you are supposedly building up for yourself at some stage in the future, which you then have to, you've got a lump of savings which you've got to turn into some kind of retirement income. And it's those things which are new, they're relatively new in the pensions world, and they are relatively fashionable, and we will see to some extent why, and you will actually see that a number of the countries in this part of the world have got them, but also a number of countries don't have them. Kosovo, I do point out, sort of looks a bit different from the rest, because there's nothing in the second column there. So Kosovo is a sort of outlier, because it's only got one thing at one extreme and another thing which you could almost say at the other extreme. Just to compare this to kind of other parts of Central and Eastern Europe, this is the part of the world which I actually sort of knew and sort of had studied in much more detail earlier. You can see some similarities in the way in which these columns are filled in. You will notice those items with stars against them, and that's the interesting thing, because those mandatory savings accounts where you actually made to participate in some saving your future became widespread in this part of the world in the in the post-socialist, basically in the 2000s onwards, they became widespread. And that was the big pension reform of those parts of the world, as they claimed to be establishing pension systems more appropriate for market-oriented economies. So we're moving away from socialism and the way in which things are done then into something else. Substantial reforms across a number of them. But in the more recent past, and this is sort of the post-onset of the global crisis, an unwinding of a lot of those reforms and a movement back from the direction in which we're going. That's something which I have written about and published about, and people who want to see more of the gory details of that, I can push them onto things that I have written. But I mean, it is interesting that there you have got quite a lot of stars. So,
this role band classification, what could that mean?
Sorry.
This role band classification, the last column.
Oh, that was only to see. So this tried to put together whether these countries had. Relatively generous publicly financed systems versus not very generous publicly financed systems. So some of them were kind of
Low spending is not very generous.
So low spending tends to be that This was part of the classification to see whether, you know, kind of you were more fiscally challenged than you were. So it was a mixture of fiscally challenged plus, to some extent, the size of the demographic pressures as well. But that in general, some places were considered to be more profligate under this than others. But that's probably less important from my point of view. I don't actually use this. So, I mean, what had people been doing in, and it was a sort of central and southeastern Europe. I mean, if we're talking about Europe, picture here, that over the last two decades in general, there had been attempts to adjust pension systems, and there was a way in which you could classify these reforms into two sorts, one of which was parametric, the other was this term paradigmatic. Parametric suggesting fiddling about, let's say, largely with the details. So you could change your pension system by, as I give examples here, moving the age of entitlement up. But you can see sort of, you see the items listed there. Various, in comparison to what were termed paradigmatic reforms, where it was really moving to an entirely new way of doing it. And this moving to mandatory individual savings accounts and getting people to do it like that, rather than doing it through some kind of immediate, effectively fiscal transfer, was the kind of paradigmatic reform, which particularly international financial institutions, particularly organisations like the World Bank, had been interested. I remember in, I think it was about 2000, I was at the OECD at the time, going to a meeting where the World Bank was trying to tell people in, this was Central and Eastern Europe, what they ought to be doing, and was sort of denouncing what those lot over there, whoever those lot over there was, had been doing, and saying they had been engaging in merely parametric reforms. And this is where, you know, sort of parametric becomes a pejorative term. I mean, you weren't doing anything like enough, you lot. You've got to do something really novel and substantial if you really want to get to grips with what's going on. But these paradigmatic reforms and these moves to individual mandatory savings account actually had substantial problems. And they had substantial problems because they brought with them this thing called transition costs. And for those of you who are not specialists in this, I'm going to try and tell you what transition costs were all about. Effectively, let's assume that Platon is making a contribution into a pension system. The government is played by Antigone here. So he gives some money to Antigone, and Antigone gives it out again to Talia because she's the pensioner. Right, okay, so there's a straight transfer like this. Let's assume that Platon is putting in every day or week or month or something like that 10 units into the pension system, and those 10 units of currency which he's putting into the pension system are being used to pay the pensioners, which could be Talia and Alex, right? So the money's coming in, the money's going out. Now, transition costs are involved, is what happens if we switch from this kind of pay-as-you-go system into a funded pension scheme. So now Platon is not putting in money to pay for Talia and Alex, but he's actually putting away money for his own purposes. But Talia and Alex have built up pension rights, which Antigone the state has got to pay them, but Antigone the state has now no longer got the money which she's going to pay them with. But you've got those claims, so the money's actually got to be paid. So all of a sudden, there's a drop of income to you, but the expenditure requirements remain there. So there is a hole. Those are the transition costs which one has to worry about with a reform like that. Because although setting up a mandatory savings account system at some stage in the future will remove all the obligations for paying pensions from Antigone whatsoever if Demetrius is a brand new worker who has never contributed into the state system. He never builds up any entitlements, so you know there are no obligations to him in the future. But all these remaining pensioners have got obligations towards them, which have got to be fulfilled. And there are substantial, at least temporary costs which are associated with these. And in fact, those costs extend into the future for as long as there are still people who have built up any entitlement under the old system to have claims under it. However much they, you know, kind of however much they might be spending some of their life in the new system, they're also spending some part of their life, and they built up entitlements under the old system. So at this stage there actually becomes a double cost, because now Antigone has got to pay out pensions still, but she hasn't got the income to do so. And how does she actually solve this? What's she supposed to do with this? And I remember when I was at the OECD and we used to talk about this, you know, sort of, we used to write about this and what you could do, and there'd be listed about sort of five or six different ways in which, you know, you could try and fill the hole or repair the damage. And, you know, there were a list of the, so there were possible things which you could do to make up for it. Of course, all of these things, most of these opportunities, you could have done in any case. You know, kind of, if you wanted to save money, you might be making cuts in expenditures on other things. You might have been raising additional income resources in any case. And so this is actually completely unrelated to pension reform. You know, you could have been doing it in any case. And in the end, all of these sort of seem to forget that money is ultimately fungible. And, you know, kind of if you need money, you need money. It doesn't matter whether it's for paying for pensions, paying for schools, paying for jet bombers or whatever. That's money is money and money, and that's all that matters. And ultimately, all of these governments, in the end, were finding themselves in a situation where they had lower revenues with similar outgoings and therefore were building up debt. And you can actually see that this then starts creating substantial problems when one gets into a period of increasing fiscal difficulties. So you sort of the post-2008, people are increasingly looking at government debt, the size of government debt, and these countries which have done reforms like this have suddenly found, well, these reforms might have been wonderful in 70 years in the future, but I've got to live with European rules, or I'm aspiring to be a member of the European Union, or I have got the international financial institutions looking over my shoulder and worrying about my government debt in any case. And you're doing this rather costly, you've engaged in this rather costly paradigmatic reform, and suddenly, you know, kind of it becomes rather expensive, and then you start winding back again, hence all the stars in the previous tables which I showed you. So a lot of unwinding. If you're actually talking about what happened recently, it's actually, in a sense, going backwards, going back towards a bit more towards where we were. And I give some examples of, you know, of what was going on in particular countries. So sometimes, you know, Croatia was an example where, you know, there was supposed to be an accelerated amount going into being switched from pay-as-you-go pensions into funded accounts, and that was supposed to be going up, and that was sort of frozen at a certain level. And sometimes there were actually even complete closures down, and the money that was built up in these systems was actually effectively nationalised by the state and then used either directly or indirectly for pension payments or just to kind of reduce government debt. And the Balkan countries were not alone in this, because this had been going on in Central and Eastern Europe already. Hungary was one of the classic sort of first movers on this, but Hungary was not a first mover. Any of you who know about the sort of the Argentinian crisis of 2008, you know, it sort of it happened, you know, the first place where it happened there. But it's not just banana republics of South America, or rather dodgy places of Central and Eastern Europe who've been engaging in activities like that. And there is an amusing paper of mine called Pension Funds as Piggy Banks, which shows that this has been going on in thoroughly, between inverted commas, respectable places much closer to home, some of which are not very far down the road here. So a lot of actually recent reform was actually sort of coming in this backward direction, but there were some kind of people who were also moving in the other direction. And one of the ones which sort of came up was sort of Armenia, who kind of suddenly, but everybody else is going in one direction, Armenia suddenly moved off in the paradigmatic reform direction. And I have been looking at Serbia a little bit in the recent times, and when is there continuous rumours about what might happen there, and whether, in fact, they're one of the holdouts, you could say, stuck with the old system. But the old system's in a dreadful mess because they're not getting enough contributions in. They've got obligations, their population's ageing, so they're in a real mess. So some people are saying, you know, kind of you've got to throw the whole thing overboard and do something substantially different. So it's the changes are in a multiplicity of directions. What kind of problems did countries who are thinking about reforms actually face? Because the direction of reform has been in this sort of fiscalization, and certainly the pressure is still there to engage in these paradigmatic reforms. And yet, one is talking about an environment which is very, very unfavourable to this. And so I was interested in the nature of the institutions and the context in which such reforms, if they were to occur, might take place. And one actually knows that in this part of the world, the record is rather distressing. I mean, most people know the pyramid investment scandal of Albania, which was kind of at a relatively early stage in Albania's transition, and had and caused an awful lot of fairly poor, well, in fact, by no means, most of them were very poor and pretty unsophisticated, whether you like to call it however you like to interpret the term unsophisticated, people who in probably rather desperate circumstances were looking for opportunities to possibly, they thought, make some easy money, but ended up by losing a lot of money. Now, you know, the analogy between sort of Ponzi schemes and pension schemes, depending on who you talk to, you know, kind of, but people will certainly use that analogy, and certainly, you know, kind of pension schemes which are based upon intermediate institutions actually provide a whole lot of other opportunities, rightly or wrongly, for people to be distrustful of what's going on. Pension schemes didn't perform terribly well in the post-socialist period either, partly because certainly in the last, you know, sort of 8-10 years, we've been living through fairly disastrous wider macroeconomic circumstances, which has impact upon returns from lots of financial institutions. And I wish Will had been here. I hoped he was going to be here, because Will always mentions the case of Kosovo and says, you know, well, the case of Kosovo is the fact that, you know, sort of shows you only too well how disastrous these pension schemes are, because you can actually show Kosovo pension system, savings pension system goes up like this, and then 2008 it goes down like this. Most of Will's analysis stopped shortly after that. And in fact, if you follow this through, it does go back up again. And if Will had been here, I would have said to him, well, yes, I mean, the Kosovo pension system might look a bit dodgy, but it went like that. Those of you who are employed at the London School of Economics who participate in the USS pension scheme, which at least some of us sitting around here do, if they bother to actually look at the returns on the USS pension scheme, which I do when I'm not looking quite as far afield as places like Kosovo, I've actually monitored rather closely, you will find that it went also and went like that as well. And I'm not sure that, I mean, I was actually going to try and plot USS against the Kosovo pension scheme to see who had done worse, but I mean,
thanks for making us feel better.
Yeah. The, I suppose, well, no, I'm not going to
say. We had a readjustment of pensions.
You did have a readjustment, but that was mere parametric reform, he said, looking down his nose. There were bad experiences. There were some people who did actually, you know, sort of were actually trying to put. Some countries actually effectively were telling these. The World Banks and the whatevers who were suggesting to them that really they weren't terribly interested. And some countries got away with this. I mean, Slovenia was a classic case where, you know, politically it was the nature of the Slovenian political system is sort of is perhaps somewhat unusual with respect to some of its neighbours, but you know they were perhaps sort of much more corporatist sort of controlled markets than anywhere else, and they said, you know, we really don't want to go down this, and we're really kind of quite happy with what we've got, and we're not at this stage badly in debt, and therefore, you know, we don't have to come sort of cap in hand to you, and therefore, in order to encourage you to help us, we have to look like we're doing the right thing with respect to our pensions. Serbia stayed. Serbia's in a real mess, but nevertheless, they kind of resisted this. So there have been some suggestions. We don't want to go down that route, however fashionable it might be. The Armenian reform, which I was looking at, you know, kind of actually, we don't learn very much about Armenia and hear very much about Armenia most of the time, but when they actually introduced this system, it brought riots onto the street with people using normally you don't get riots on the street in the case of pension reform, but actually some people were sufficiently savvy or managed to excite enough people to suggest that, you know, kind of, nobody was really trusting what was going on at all. And then again, if you're talking about, you know, financially based and rather sophisticated sort of structures, one does have to look at the general competence of the institutions which have to manage that, whether they be intermediate financial institutions or whether they be the government itself. And you then, anybody who's interested in the metrics of good governments, good administration, kind of reads the indexes which are produced by the Transparencies Internationals or the World Bank sort of listings of this world, will find that most of these countries are actually sort of right down here. And one reads enough about sort of scandals with respect to pensions, even in this part of the world, which on its World Bank metrics and Transparency International metrics is sort of right up here. So you can kind of understand why people might be reluctant to participate, and indeed why even sort of outside financial institutions will be fairly careful about how they get involved in this. And it will also be important, these governance metrics, for, you know, kind of whether you as an outsider are prepared to invest in this country, hence the FDI as a potential metric. But equally, you know, kind of if you were thinking, well, I've got to save for my pension, where am I putting my savings? Well, if, you know, kind of if outsiders aren't putting their money into the country, you might wonder why you should be putting your money into the country either. And there might be good reasons why you actually want to put it somewhere else, of which the case of Kosovo becomes particularly important, because Kosovo has a system which is based upon funded individual accounts, and none of the money which is collected for these, or effectively almost none of the money which is collected for these individual accounts gets invested in Kosovo at all. And in fact, the remit of the pension fund is to send it somewhere else. And I will come back to that a bit later. But, you know, kind of these government metrics of themselves might be one reason why this doesn't actually happen. Let's think also about, let's move away from these very broad contexts to actually look at the institutions which might be managing financially based pensions. And one of the things is that when you're putting your money into these things, you're giving it to a series of fund managers and a series of institutions who are having to deal with you not as a mass and not just as an index number, but are actually having to manage a whole account for you, and which might partly be influenced by you saying, I want you to invest it in this way or I want you to invest it in that way, which of course assumes a level of sophistication which probably most of us haven't got. The advantage of having USS is that there's some idiots somewhere down in, they're close to St. Paul's Cathedral who are actually doing it for us, so we don't have to think about it. And when they screw it up, which they do quite regularly, it doesn't actually matter for, at least for Spilus and me, because we're old enough, it actually matters to Vasilis a bit because he's younger and they have made some changes in the system. But when they do screw it up, we, in the first instance, don't take the hit. Actually, the person who takes the hit is the our employer, which might explain certain other things which are going on at the moment, not just in the School of Comics, but possibly in the wider university system as well, because we're all in the same boat together. But actually, the cost of managing these individual accounts is a hell of a lot higher than it is managing the collective accounts which USS has. And you actually look at some of the charging levels which are associated with these countries, and some of them are very high. I mean, look at Bulgaria, they're charging 2% of assets under management. You can't see it. That is white. This is white. This is hard. It actually, on my, when I looked at it on my computer, it looked quite nice, but why is it so?
But that's a picture, it's not a. I know.
You see, it all looks very nice here. He can see it.
There it is.
Look very pretty.
Disappearing charges. That's what they're supposed to do.
This makes it actually worse. You know, there you are. You see, it all looks right. It'll look terribly nice on my slide. Okay, right. That's better. Thank you. This is wonderful. Right. So you can actually see, I mean, 2% of assets under management. Now, I put at the far end, I put the kind of recently, or relatively recently introduced sort of equivalent of that in the UK, which has got charges at just under 0.5% of assets under management. So,
you
know,
notional accounts or real accounts?
These are notional. These are real accounts. This is what these are. All these are real accounts. These are savings accounts. So these are countries which have got these savings accounts, and this is what they're charging. So every year of what you save, the equivalent of 2%, in the case of Bulgaria, actually disappears for charges. And you can actually see in that little table at the bottom what the impact of charges is on what you save. So if there were no charges at all, after 30 years of saving, everything you save was just sort of building up in your account. So, you know, kind of the 30 years savings under a no charge, you get 100 units, sort of equivalent to 100% of things. And you can see as it works down, even with this only charging 0.5% of assets under management, after 30 years, 10% of what you saved has disappeared into charges. When you get down to 2%, assets under management charges, 30% has disappeared after 30 years. That's a hell of a lot. That's a big hit. That's going to, you're doing the saving, but this money is going into something else. It's going into paying the fund managers, it's paying the asset managers, it's paying the administrators, it's paying for the I don't know what. And those kinds of charges are, yes, you can see, not unusual. These charge levels into the bargain were charge levels which, I mean, with the exception of Kosovo and the UK NES system, were charges which I collected took from what the World Bank was quoting. And the World Bank, which has been a propagator of such reforms and tends to see them in the best possible light, if anything, is actually underestimating these charges. There are plenty of reasons to actually think that, you know, kind of that is, you could probably add a little bit onto that as well. So you know, there is quite deleterious consequences from moving in this direction. This is interesting because this all works like this, except it doesn't.
Can I ask the technical assistant if he can manage to do this? It looks beautiful here.
Try to concentrate. There's a light blue line at the bottom.
It fills right up. It fills right up to the government securities are at the bottom of that, where there's a very pale blue. If you're sitting close enough to me, you can see that. And there is another sort of blue right at the very top, which deals with other. But that's at the top. The point which I want you to note about this is that these countries have very limited and underdeveloped capital markets. They don't have, if they do have stock exchanges, they have very few things which are quoted on these stock exchanges and very few things which you and I, or anybody else, because I went back to the FDI question, anybody else wants to invest in either. So in fact, a lot of these schemes are actually not investing your money in things like equities, which might or might not make money, but actually all they're doing is buying up government debt. Now let's go back to the analogy that we had earlier, where we've got Platon and Antigone and Talia and Alex and so forth going on there. Now, what's going on now is that you, Talia, are investing your money in a government bond which Antigone has issued. And at some stage, when you come to retire, you've got to turn that claim on resources into some kind of income. So you're going to go and cash in your bond, aren't you? Which means that either Antigone's got to go out and borrow some more money to pay you off for the bond that you're selling back, or... So effectively, I mean, she's got to go and raise some taxes to get some money to pay you.
So,
which ultimately Talia and everybody else in this room will be paying. So, you know, we've now gone to a situation where the state is actually very closely involved in this after all. We haven't got private markets. You haven't gone and invested in the Ford Motor Corporation or Apple or I don't know what else. I mean, all you're doing is investing back in the state, and effectively this isn't proper privatisation. This is merely a very slightly change the nature of the transaction that was going on through a tax and social security contribution into something where, you know, the tax and social security is being sort of replaced by either sort of borrowing or to redeem the bonds. You've got a tax in any case. So it's not really. So we've actually really still got disguised sort of public systems, even though they're talked about as systems which are based on private savings accounts. So the state is right behind them. I'm going to skip the picture of Kosovo because I sort of really. But I mean, the point about Kosovo is, you know, kind of, it's sending all this money which it's collecting abroad. At the same time as, you know, it's getting remittance money coming in, it's not actually getting a large amount of foreign direct investment because nobody can see very much to foreignly direct invest in. And the people who are sending remittance money home aren't using this remittance money to engage in productive investment in Kosovo. All they're doing is driving up the price of real estate in the country. And that's going on elsewhere across that region. You can see this in Croatia, you can see this where the similar systems are. One of the issues which I have been interested in my capacity as a pensions economist is, you know, could we use these pension schemes to finance infrastructure, because these countries have got dreadfully poor physical infrastructure. They've got pretty poor social infrastructure, if you want to expand the definition of infrastructure.
And certainly there has been some argument that pension funds, you know, or a reformed pension system could actually provide long-term finance that would satisfy infrastructure needs. That's not peculiar to this part of the world. It goes, this discussion goes on in this country, it goes on in Western Europe, it goes on elsewhere. And this is something I was talking about in Belgrade a month or so ago. But I mean, the argument really was very much, you know, kind of this is really a non-starter. And it's a non-starter for all the reasons which I was offering about, you know, sort of rules of law, inadequate financial institution. With the net result that insofar as governments are saying, well, you know, kind of there is this... there is a source of money here. They kind of tend to resort to what I call Sutton's Law. Now, Sutton's Law tells you this. Willie Sutton was an American bank robber. And eventually, Willie Sutton was caught and hauled up before the judges. And the judge thought he's got him there. And he's handing guilty and he leaves across and he says, and tell me, Mr. Sutton, why do you rob banks? And Willie Sutton says, well, Your Honour, that's where the money is. So, you know, you slightly stress, and then that sort of the stress being on the why do you rob banks, it's why do you rob banks? Why do you go to pension funds? Because that's where the money is. And so what one actually finds is sort of cases of governments actually sort of seeing these things and possibly as a price of not interfering with these pension funds or not interfering with them quite as much as they might otherwise interfere with them, says, well, you know, I won't unreform, I'll let you continue, but subject to you giving me and making sure that you use your resources to make investments which I want rather than investments which are necessarily in the interests of your or the people whom we're actually saving for retirement. I think, you know, kind of coming away from that, there are these more general problems, and I really am very close to the end here, because what one can see here is that there are not only short-term problems, but there are also longer-term problems. And that's going to what's going to happen when these reformed systems, whether they've only been parametrically reformed or whether they've been paradigmatically reformed, what are their implications going to be for people's retirement incomes in the medium and longer term, as well as in the short term? And if one looks at, certainly when I was working in the OECD, you tended to find that pensioners in this part of the world, if people were poor in general, pensioners certainly weren't poorer than anybody else. Pensioners did reasonably well, and one of the reasons why they did reasonably well is because everybody had worked under real living socialism, and everybody had built up an entitlement based upon a more or less complete work history. But future cohorts, current workers and younger people are not going to face the same circumstances. And particularly in this part of the world where there's been an awful lot of disruption to people's working lives, where there have been substantial economic crises. In this part of the world where there have been substantial political crises, fragmentations, which mean that records get lost, even if people did have contributions records. You know, nobody quite knows what money they got. Then they're putting it into potentially precarious financial institutions where it gets lost as well. So what happens, what are future pensioners going to look like, relatively speaking? And I suggest that there are a lot of things which are going to suggest that pensioners are going to be a lot poorer in this part of the world than they used to be. Now, interestingly enough, the World Bank, who was the great propagator of paradigmatic reforms, actually said, even at the time when it was advocating such reforms, that quote at the bottom came from one of the very early books, and it actually said, you know, kind of, these rather sophisticated financially based systems are all very well and good for kind of sophisticated, advanced, well developed economies, but they are not really so for transition and low income economies. So, you know, kind of, this doesn't seem to be an appropriate response. So this is where I kind of really finish off by saying, well, you know, kind of, well, what ought they be doing as opposed to what they have been doing? And maybe they ought to be thinking not of rather sophisticated pension systems, which a lot of this paradigmatic reform was all about, but actually going back to something much more basic. And this is why I quote the examples of Costco, and I quote the example of Costco quite a lot, is that maybe what you should be thinking about is, let's make sure that the state can at least provide for the very poor and at least eradicate poverty in old age. People who've got more and have got more resources maybe ought to have opportunities to engage in their own provision, but I'm not sure. So this is a bit like Kosovo, but it's not like Kosovo, because in Kosovo everybody's got to do it. Let's say you can do it. We'll make it available for you to do. So that those who want to can do more, and there should perhaps be an infrastructure which enables them to do so. But let's actually make this as simple as possible. So we have this very basic thing, and there's something voluntarily for the rest of them. That's one thing which I think that people ought to... And if they are going to set up structures, they need to set up well-managed structures. And the reason why I keep coming back to Kosovo, in fact, is that although there is an awful lot which is awfully wrong with what they are doing, it is actually a reasonably well-managed, partly because of the way in which Kosovo got set up with these sort of external influences and oversights. A structure was set up which... If you were going to do something like that, and I'm not saying you should, but if you were going to do something like that, this was probably doing it a hell of a lot better than most of those other countries in this part of the world, and in parts of the world which are sort of close, and possibly even some parts of the world which are very close to us here. But it was actually reasonably well done.
1 minute.
Right. But otherwise, you know, kind of don't try and do anything particularly clever. But bear in mind that your capacity to provide reasonable retirement incomes for anybody in older age is actually to have an economy and an infrastructure, which I mean in very general terms, I don't mean physical infrastructure, but I mean a social infrastructure as well, which actually is conducive to people being able to produce things, generate wealth, and have a system which allows income to be redistributed. And so this about getting the economy right, stupid as well, this part of the world, the Balkans in particular. And when I first visited, I mean, the thing that I, you know, we have this notion of Balkans, and one of the things which struck me as really bizarre there was the re-Balkanization of the Balkans. So actually, you know, kind of, in terms of getting an area which is viable economically, everything is actually pedaling in the opposite direction, because the whole place is being fragmented up into borders, controls, and things like that. And what was never a terribly successful economic entity is being fractured, re-balkanized, and I think, you know, sort of getting some of the things back. And then in the end, which I always say, you know, kind of, you've really got to start understanding what aging means, what fiscal transfer, what income transfers, what resource transfers actually mean, and how you can best do that. So that's what I will leave you with. Now, you are now allowed to ask me questions, but only in Serbian. I'm actually allowed to ask the first question, because I always am allowed to ask the first question. Then I will make it sufficiently long, and then I will answer myself at great length.
You make my life so easy.
And then everybody else can go home and relax.
So is that the exam question?
Yeah.
Right, but no, thanks. Let's give a round of applause. So we won't give the first question to Bernard, so I will start with Antigone.
Okay, the state speaks for itself. You started your interesting presentation by stressing some structural characteristics that would create problems to all sorts of pension systems, like very low employment rate, high degree of informality, high unemployment rate and stuff. And I've been wondering to what extent the paradigmatic systems change, the proposed paradigmatic changes suffer from these original sins of the general economic situation that does not really feed enough money in one or other form for the pension system. And if this is mainly the thing, then why not contemplate of ways to bring back people into jobs and then leave more open space for different pensions arrangements?
That's effectively what I hope I more or less said. In other words, you know, kind of there are it's not fertile ground for trying to do anything which is particularly exotic. So I think it is almost criminally irresponsible to do that. And that's why I say, you know, kind of quote, I actually quoted in the end the advocates of making these changes, and I actually said, you know, this is unsuitable for doing it there. Yes, I mean, I think, you know, you've got to get an awful lot of things right. And if you've got an awful lot of things right, then maybe you can do clever things like that. But they're not terribly necessary, and they don't actually add. The added value of them is only limited in any case. So yes, I mean, I'd entirely agree with you. I mean, you've actually got to worry about all those things which are listed there, plus some of those list of, you know, poorly performing structures. Get that right. If you get that right, you worry about what you're doing with your older people. We'll still be there, but there'll be a bit less.
Can I take just prerogative and ask the next question? It follows from Antigone's. It's basically probably the same question. So the way I see it, there's two issues. One is about sustainability of whatever system you have in place, and the other one is about sort of the neoliberal turn or whatever, the commodification of the system, where you move from one system to another. I don't remember what's the right terms. I'm not quite sure whether, in the absence of the demographic pressures, is the claim that the, you know, if the demographic pressures or whatever other pressures remain as they are, the privatization, commodification of the system will resolve the sustainability issue, or are they these two things in a separate, so you say, okay, let's make it more efficient in economic terms, or commodification, and we will continue looking at the sustainability issues. Is it low participation rates? Is it aging? Or whatever else is the
problem? The real problem is the challenge is the demography. Now, I mean, go back to the example which I gave when I was using Platon, Antigone, Thalia, and Alex as examples. I mean, the point is that we've got these old people who are, let's call them non-producers and consumers, and we've got some people who are producers, and they might be consuming as well. But you know, it's the relationship between the producers and the consumers which is the important one, and it's actually complete. It's very much a second order question as to whether you choose to redistribute money from the producers to the consumers via a tax and contribution system, or through, which is very direct, or through a set of intermediaries which involve people purchasing financial assets at some stage in their life and selling off financial assets at other stages in their life. I mean, very crudely, if the problem is that there are too many consumers relative to the producer, then by the time Platon gets to cash in on his assets, because he's actually got to turn those savings which he's got, you know, on a piece of paper into money. Somebody's actually got to buy
the assets up from him, and what's the power of the people who can buy those assets, and therefore how much is he going to get from? And those kinds of things are entirely determined by the number of people who are supplying assets and the number of people who are purchasing assets. The point is that Platon might have a safe full of share certificates and government bonds, but those are worth nothing to him whatsoever when he reaches the age of 65 or 70 or something like that, because he can't actually eat those things. He's actually got to, well, I mean, it's as simple as that. He's actually got to go out and turn those things into money. And, you know, kind of it's all about, you know, it's how many steps you've got in the sort of mediation process. But it's still the case that, you know, there are some people who are producing some things who've got something to sell, and some people who've got, you know, who are trying to sell things off.
You're right, but this goes against the balkanization thing, that if you're a Kosovar, and you're limited to investing in Kosovo, it's a different thing from being a Kosovo and being able to invest in all through the Balkans, or even better still, all through Europe or the world financial system. So, in which case, I mean, because in the latter case, you are hedging, and the danger of aging. Whereas if you're just limited in investing everything in Kosovo, it's very difficult to tell the difference between a funded system and a pay-as-you-go system.
That's the point. I mean, the point is that in Kosovo they send it all abroad, because there's nothing you can do with that. But the problem is that you're not actually hedging it against the ageing problem. You might be hedging it against the fact that, you know, sort of the Kosovan economy is a worthless place where there's nothing that you can invest in which will get you anything. So you actually sort of say, I'm going to send it to Germany or the Netherlands or somewhere like this, because, you know, they're nice sort of responsible places. The problem is that the Germany and the Netherlands, you know, kind of in general, has actually got, well, in terms of, actually with respect to Kosovo, they've got worse age, they've got worse demographic problems. But, you know, if you were sitting in Croatia or somewhere like that, you're not hedging against aging. And the point is that almost all the places which, you know, kind of whether you're in Croatia or whether you're in you know, kind of most of those other places which you've done that, is that the places where you're investing your money, if you're investing into abroad, have got demographics which are exactly the same as your own demographics. So you're not hedging that problem. And it doesn't, maybe they're slightly more efficient financial managers, maybe they don't steal quite as much, but that's the only thing you can say.
They have different fiscal problems, fiscal systems, so you're hedging the fiscal cost. But I wanted to actually make a different view. In your list of pension policy relevant features, you didn't mention labour mobility, and in places like Bulgaria or Albania, half the population might disappear and go and work somewhere else and then come back. And that presumably would should have some policy relevance, in the sense that, you know, what kind of system do you prefer?
Well, it would if you could, but I mean, given that these places, one of the it's not only that, you know, some of your records are lost in the past because we're in this part of the world, civil wars, which actually destroy things, but actually, you know, the country that you were in is broken up, and I'm not, you know, it's not necessarily clear that there is recognition of entitlements built up here for people who are living there. This is a big enough problem in Western Europe, even in sophisticated Western Europe, to get kind of recognition of acquired rights across borders. It's not terribly easy, even in sophisticated, between inverted commas, countries like the UK, to get recognition of employment rights that you had here with employment rights that you had there, where here is company A in this country and there is company B in this country. So this is a real problem in any case. Now, in an ideal world where, you know, kind of there really was a Europe of, and there really was a single market, and this might be, but, you know, we're nowhere near that. We're nowhere near that in the part of the world which we know around here. So you think about, you know, kind of the difficulties to doing that in an area which, you know, if you look at its tendencies, is for fragmentation. There seem to be real problems. So I mean, that's why I say, you know, kind of be extraordinarily modest about what you want to try and do and what you think you can do. And I know it's not very fashionable because it kind of says, you know, kind of, well, actually, you haven't even really got out of primary school yet. But that's actually what the reality is. And in fact, if we started recognising things like that as opposed to sort of embracing you and saying you're the 28th, 29th or 30th member of the European Union and you're kind of capable of all the things and can enjoy all the things which we, the rest of us, have. This, as those of you who know me from Hellenic Observatory days, is one of the reasons why we've got countries which are already members in the, between inverted commas, shits that they're in, because we actually sort of spend a lot of time deceiving them that actually they were, you know, kind of indeed entitled to do things like that and permitted them to do that until we suddenly find that they were up to here, and then we kind of wanted to renege upon any obligations that we had for getting them in that situation. I think it's grossly irresponsible.
Okay. More questions? Was that a question?
Can I, maybe it's not a question, it's more of a comment. So I realize your point, because it's being discussed in Croatia as well very often, actually. So your arguments are more or less against this mandatory pension fund, which is somehow privately funded but invested in government securities or whatever, which is obviously similar in all the countries that are using this. However, we need to go back to the beginning and to the issue of a problem of demography in all these countries, except Kosovo, as you mentioned, which is really an issue. And Vasilis mentioned there is the issue of sustainability of the fiscal system, which is one side of the coin, but also there is the adequacy issue. So how big pensions can be from the pay-as-you-go system. You mentioned already that they are very low in terms of average wages, and wages are low, so these people are quite poor. So actually, this could be a way to somehow increase the level of pensions for future pensioners. I do agree with you with all these problems about ways of investing the money, about the how do you call it? I don't know, this the fees that pension funds take out from the investments. For example, in Croatia, during the last couple of years, the ratio of workers, or people who were paying contributions, and pensioners was 1.13 over 1, which is almost 1-to-1. So already now, and in next 30 years, it will be even worse. So this is an issue that needs to be overcome somehow. So perhaps this is not the best way, but the old pay-as-you-go system is apparently not working as well.
But the old pay-as-you-go system is not working. It's not the old pay-as-you-go system isn't working. The demographics are not working. That's the first thing. The societal decisions about how income gets distributed between different social groups and whether there is a role for public policy to engage in redistribution or not is also not working. Those are the kinds of things which actually aren't working. That's what you've got to worry about. And if you make decisions that we're going to do something about that in particular ways, so there are certain things which facilitate that and perhaps make it easier or more complicated to do. But I wouldn't try and do it in a complicated fashion. But it comes back, you know, kind of, it does come back to what I said at the end of, you know, you've got to get the economy right to get any of these things right. And you've actually, yes, there are all kinds of problems with sort of entitlement pensions which get passed out. I mean, it was the Croatia case which Platon and I were talking about at the end of lunch time today. I mean, one of the reasons why there is an awful lot of pensioners to people who are workers is because one of the grounds for an entitlement to a pension that you can get in Croatia is to be a war pensioner. Now, you know, in a country where just about everybody on this basis can get a war pension, you're actually, this is asking for problems as it is. It's asking for problems. You've got all kinds of legacies of previous sort of systems where there were rather low pension ages, even in, you know, kind of in the old Yugoslavia. This is a big problem across Central Europe as well. There are big problems like that, but there are big problems with demography, and you cannot escape from this demographic problem. What you've actually got to do is to think seriously about how you can get people into moving from being pure consumers to being workers, and who are going to be the producers, under what circumstances, and who's entitled to consume under what circumstances. Unless you can prove to me that putting up a setting up a pensions savings scheme encourages you to work harder, work longer, and declare more of your income, and it actually does that, then you're not actually telling me anything which is very useful. And we had this problem right back when I was sort of doing this with the OECD, who, you know, kind of was, if it wasn't quite as wedded to this kind of reform as the World Bank, it was pretty kind of ideologically, so, you know, kind of, I was supposedly going out and advocating at least parametric reform with a bit of paradigmatic reform as well. That was sort of my job, was I was supposed to do this kind of thing. I was supposed to advance the intellectual arguments for this. Empirically, in those countries which have done this kind of thing, and we can go right the way back to Chile in 1981, which was kind of the poster child of that 1994 World Bank report. And it said, you know, you can do this. So Chile did this. And the idea was that, you know, kind of, if you were saving and your pension was related to what you had saved, so the more you saved and the longer you saved, the more you would get, then this would encourage you to engage in formal economic activity and to register and to make sure that, you know, kind of what you were earning got registered, because that built up contributions. In 30 years or so and more of the sort of the Chilean reform, the level of informality in the Chilean economy stayed kind of more or less constant. There was no change whatsoever. And, you know, we can see this in other parts of Central and Eastern Europe, which have tried this kind of thing. It's actually had almost zero effect. So, you know, kind of the economic argument of kind of good neoclassical economists like me kind of ought to be kind of advocating and saying, you know, kind of, well, if you did this, this is what ought to happen. It does not seem to actually be working. There are all kinds of much bigger structural impediments to allowing that to happen. And that's why I think we ought to worry about this.
But Bernard, can I follow up? Isn't it that if you actually move to whatever these defined contributions, away from the pay-as-you-go system, then you deal with the demographic problem, in the sense that, you know, the demographic, well, you deal with it, but the demographic problem doesn't matter anymore. Even if you're the only person contributing, you will get your money then. What it does is that it creates an adequacy problem, in the sense that if then the person...
No, it doesn't overcome the demographic. It doesn't overcome the demographic. It's not that if it did, it would...
That's the idea.
Yeah.
That is the complete myth. That is what is particularly pernicious about this. Because the point is that if we are talking about buying and selling these share certificates that
well, that depends on the economy, on how the economy does. Yeah. So, assuming that the economy does equally well at all points in time, which is a big assumption, then it does make, so the transition to the paradigmatic change does make the sustainability of the system independent of the aging.
No, it doesn't make it independent of the aging, because the point is the it's non-independent of the aging because you have got to, there are a certain number of people who are engaging in saving, so there's a certain number of people who are actually buying financial products, which affects the price of those financial products, and there are a certain number of people who are selling financial products. Now, if there are an awful lot of workers and if there are an awful lot of people who are hitting retirement age and not very many, so we've now got Talia and Alex out there flogging off their share certificates, but there's only one person who wants to buy them. Their share certificates are not going to be worth anything like as much as if there were a whole lot of people bidding to try and get those share certificates. So the demographics do not go out of it at all. And that is the myth of this whole thing, is that it is demographically neutral. It's actually not demographically neutral. And there is an awful lot of people in the finance world who now actually go and sit and try and look at the sort of price and demand of bonds and shares and relate this to demographic developments. And sort of one of the reasons why are we getting the kind of financial indicators that we are currently getting that is related to the fact that we've got too many people going through dissaving. In other words, it's the Alex's and the Talia's selling off things, and there aren't enough active people who are engaging in the saving. So then you look at
secular stagnation.
Yes, and this is one of the, so everybody who's interested in secular stagnation, I come and give you a talk about secular stagnation. Very good at doing that. But if people are sort of listing off, what are the contributors to secular stagnation, demography lists fairly highly amongst that.
And last question.
Talia, let Talia.
Okay. A quick comment by Plato and then the last question by Talia.
I agree with Bernard that it's the production relations which are important, and the way you organize your pension system is sort of smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
But it's the smoke and mirrors that people use to understand what is happening to them. And what the old pay-as-you-go system is a uniquely bad and uniquely distorting picture to go through, and that kind of screws things up because it gives the impression to people that money grows on trees, which is the example of the war pensioners in Croatia and lots of others, which in other places which I won't mention, and the World Bank type of defined contribution mix system gives. It's another set of smoke and mirrors which might give you better incentives to do what you have to be doing, which is to meet a real problem by real changes and not just financial ones.
Except that look at those distrust indicators. So those are real problems.
Yeah.
Okay.
Those distrust indications don't just affect the pension system. I mean, those.
Yeah, it's the part of the whole.
So if you can use the pension system to get trust in general, then you're moving in the right direction.
I would say chickens and eggs here. I think if you had the trust, you could have the pension system, but the pension system won't build the trust. Granger causality.
I wanted just to say something that I understand, because a lot of things I do. It seems that the element of time is very important, and not only in the case of pensions, for example, because you assume that something will happen in years and you don't control a lot of things. You don't know if you have a state, if whatever. But maybe it could be a little bit similar to what happens with children in the education system. If you're not in a society where you try to make money from your children as soon as possible, as soon as they can walk, and you invest as families or as a state or whatever organization for years, you never know what will happen. Like, will there be jobs in this sector where you created these universities or whatever or not? And maybe also a little bit the same thing with other forms of investment, more short term, like someone is in agriculture, he thinks he will have, I don't know, a harvest this year, he makes a loan and then there is no harvest because there was rain or something, and he finds himself in a difficult situation. So is there a way to sort of imagine different options, or the way to think that things will go in the future is just a replication of what we are actually living, which would be maybe a little bit far from reality.
Are your models good enough?
Well, yes. I mean, I really think it's demanding an awful lot of. I spent, quite a lot of my past sort of propagating and teaching pensions economics, and I was, continually brought to a stop by how little I understood, and I was kind of doing it as a full-time job. You're a social psychologist. That's, in a sense, your full-time job. How much are you supposed to understand this? I mean, how much knowledge do we have about the future? I don't know. How much knowledge do we have about the way in which markets are going to perform? I don't know. Which is why I come back to the question that, ultimately this is a political issue rather than anything else. Because actually, let's take your harvest. If something does go wrong with your harvest, either you're going to starve, or, I don't know, the other people, maybe it's just your harvest in the village and the rest of the village come round and support you. So there is some kind of political decision, between inverted commas, which is made to sort that out. What we actually see is that in some cases where some of these pension systems have failed to live up to their promise, is that the government actually finds itself under intense pressure to step in and rectify and patch up some of the difficulties that have been caused. And this is where you enter into a whole other game, because if the reason why you actually made the reform in the first place was because it was going to save you some money, if it all kind of moved along, and then the thing screws up, and then all of a sudden, under kind of rather short-term pressures, you have to step in and patch the thing up, this ultimately might come to be more expensive than if you hadn't gone down this not necessarily very wise road in the first place. But the decision, all of a sudden, we haven't got a market determined outcome because we've got a politically determined outcome, because the market has produced outcomes which ultimately become socially and politically unsustainable. And the costs of that are costs which we really need to start thinking about, and we don't start thinking about enough. So you're entirely right about, uncertainty and responses to uncertainty. And it's perfectly right to look at it in exactly the way that you do, because the responses are exactly the kind of responses which you actually, your let's call it very simple, model or perception actually requires for a solution. And that's actually what happens. And the sooner we actually start coming to terms, and that is really why, my absolute throwaway line is this one about, be able to better understand what this is all about. And if we don't understand what this is all about, we're just going to keep repeating history and keep repeating our mistakes. And that is what. I went to a meeting the other day about whether there should be a thing called an Institute for public policy or governance at this school of comics at which we are a part. And, what I ended up by saying is, it's not actually, what it's all about ultimately, it's not just that we actually do some good research here and have some bright ideas. we actually have a very, very important mission to actually communicate and enhance public understanding. And we as academics are doing a very poor job most of our time because we actually don't get involved in an awful lot of that. And some of us are rather better at it than others, and some bits of this organisation are rather better at it than some others. But there is an extraordinary gap between kind of intellectual understandings, which we actually have problems, and actually getting this across and mediating this into general understanding. I think, you know, this is really what we ought to be doing.
Good. We are out of time, but we ended with a nice punchline. So let's all thank Bernard for the presentation. Thank you for coming. We can continue with